From a dot in the middle of the map, this is Midwesternish. I'm Gina Kaufman. The city of New Orleans just took down the last of its Confederate monuments. The statues celebrated people who fought for the South in the Civil War, people who ended up on the losing side of more than a war. They were on the losing side of history. But when the monuments came down, there were two distinct reactions, protests and celebrations. Over my dead body and, finally, what took you so long? But it's not just in the Deep South that people are wrestling with this stuff.
St. Louis has a 32-foot granite memorial in Forest Park, which is the big kind of central park of St. Louis. And it reads, in part, speaking of the Confederate soldiers, their conduct was actuated by the purest patriotism, and they performed deeds of prowess such as thrill the heart of mankind with admiration.
Now there's a bill in St. Louis to remove that monument, and it sparked a heated debate. The Confederate soldiers on that statue, they now hold signs that say Black Lives Matter. Missouri's Civil War history is kind of unusual. Missouri was a slave state, but one with Union and Confederate allegiances. So in Missouri, those political divisions are nothing new. They've been there all along. On this episode, Confederate monuments in our own backyard. Let's start with the Confederate flag. What do people think of it? Depends on who you ask.
The Confederate flag has attached to it a series of incidents that, for most black people, signified hatred, submission, and a threat.
My 15-year-old brother has an interesting standpoint on it. He really likes this show called Dukes of Hazzard. So the first time he saw that flag was on the orange car that everyone drives around, and he didn't realize what the symbol was and got a lot of trouble from my parents.
If the flag represents oppression to a group of people who we have systematically denigrated and dehumanized for centuries, then it needs to come down.
The Confederate flag is a symbol of honor and protection.
Just as the swastika offends my Jewish friends and neighbors and me, the Confederate flag should offend all Americans.
There is no way that any person who considers themselves a patriotic American citizen would see themselves within 100 miles of the Confederate flag, and everyone who's flying the Confederate flag should be immediately arrested and investigated for treason.
Reporter Frank Morris looked into Confederate monuments in the Midwest a couple years ago. So, Frank, is this debate that plays out with the Confederate flag the same one that plays out with Civil War monuments?
Oh, sort of. The flag is definitely more combustible as a symbol than the monuments are. The monuments, never showed up in the Dixiecrat literature. The flag kind of had this big rebirth around the time of segregation, and the monuments are sort of always there. The monuments, though, are, arguably part of a systematic effort by the Daughters of the Confederacy to sort of reframe the motivations for the Civil War. And they popped up all over the country starting about 30 years after the close of the war.
Reframing that history in what way? That motivation in what way?
Scrubbing it of slavery, principally, but also promoting what some scholars call the myth of the lost cause. That is, that the Civil War was really a clash between these high ideals and chivalry in the South up against impossible odds to be crushed by the North. So it sort of paints the Confederacy as being victimized by the overwhelming force of the North.
Let's see what that looks like on the ground. Liberty, Missouri is a town of about 2,900 people that sits on the outskirts of Kansas City. Just like in New Orleans, there's a statue in the Liberty City Cemetery that honors Confederate soldiers who lost their lives in the Civil War. KCUR reporter Danny Wood went to Liberty to get a better understanding of how people are dealing with different ideas about how and whether to immortalize the winners and losers of that conflict.
It's a cold evening in Liberty, Missouri, and I'm standing in the local cemetery, Fairview Cemetery, alongside a Civil War memorial remembering the losing side, the Confederates, and it consists of a gray column, and on top of that, a life-size statue of a Confederate soldier holding a gun, and his big handlebar mustache makes him look rather like a stoic and reliable character. But what sort of person does he really represent? Tonight, I'm going to find out. I'm on my way to a book launch in the local Historical Society's museum on the main square.
Hello.
Hi.
The Clay County Museum and Historical Society has a 19th century wood-paneled interior that's beautiful. There are glass cabinets full of relics. An antique cannon dominates the floor of the entrance, and beyond, about 30 jovial locals, some very elegantly dressed, enjoying wine and snacks.
What's your name again?
Danny.
Okay.
I'm Jana Jesse Becker. I'm the past president of the Clay County Museum and Historical Society. I put this book
Jana tells me that her book is called Excerpts from the Diary of Judge A.H. Shelton. The excerpts are drawn from an unpublished memoir that was rediscovered in the museum a few years ago.
I found it as in, you just saw it on the shelves?
In a drawer.
Oh, really?
In a drawer.
The manuscript had been donated to the Historical Society by Alonzo Houston Shelton's granddaughter. Shelton was from Clay County, and his Civil War experience included surviving the Battle of Lexington, the Siege of Atlanta, a prisoner of war camp, and losing an arm. During that time, he also met the sweetheart he'd later marry.
He sold real estate for a long time after the war. He was a real estate man. And then he became the police judge in Excelsior.
Jana found the first-person descriptions of battles and local people so vivid, she decided to type them up and, through the museum, release these excerpts as a book. I ask her to summarize what Shelton was like. She reads a quote taken from the diary and highlighted on the book's back cover.
No nation, no state, no county on top of God's green earth ever furnished any better, any braver, any more gallant defenders of the old Constitution and for the rights of the South than noble old Clay County, Missouri.
This is Shelton, the idealist, fighting for a cause. But a few hundred feet from where we're talking, there are old houses with their slave quarters intact, where African Americans were chained to the walls. Was this old Constitution really worth defending, and how gallant were its defenders?
How does it complicate things for you when we're talking about someone who lived in a society that today would be regarded as completely morally bankrupt? Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that?
I think we have to remember that the times were different. It was just a whole different world. It wasn't right, of course, but it was what they needed to survive.
Jana says the new book contains the war entries from Shelton's diary. Anything controversial, like opinions about slavery and derogatory comments about African Americans, including any mention of the N-word, are left out. I ask if this might be sanitizing the history.
Well, I think it is sanitizing it, but we, as a museum board, discussed it and decided that's what we needed to do. But we didn't want to create any controversy or take any stand about that issue. We didn't want anybody to think that represented what we thought, because it doesn't, of course.
Not everybody at the book launch agrees with this view. I ask Liberty resident Angie Borger-Darlin how she thinks prominent people from the Confederate past should be remembered.
Oh, I think that's part of your past. This area's past. I think warts and all, that you should show it.
Tonight, it's also the Clay County Historical Society's annual meeting. But the curator, Jay Thorne, agrees to talk with me, so we squeeze behind the now closed makeshift bar to find a quiet corner. Jay wasn't involved with the publishing of the book and says he doesn't agree with the board's decision to leave out controversial material. In the original memoir, Jay says Shelton uses the N-word while expressing hatred for the anti-slavery activist John Brown. Jay thinks this passage is historically important because it demonstrates that support for slavery was a key factor motivating Shelton's fight for the Confederacy. Jay is also concerned that the excerpted diary serves revisionist historians who could use it to portray the Confederate cause as a battle for states' rights rather than a defense of slavery. He says the diary's content is important and a great read.
When we found Shelton's journal here in the museum,
It's a fantastic journal of the Civil War. And then we got a couple of collections of letters that he wrote to his fiancée. We're still working through those. They're fantastic to give insight into the thinking of that culture.
When you read Shelton's diary, you can understand why Jay and Jana are drawn to it. It hops along like a cross between Mark Twain and a boy's own adventure story. But in Jana's excerpted version, there are no spaces in the text or any indication on the pages that words are omitted. An acknowledgement only mentions editing and doesn't explain further. At a cafe a couple of doors down from the museum, I meet with Cecilia Robinson, a volunteer historian for the Clay County African American Heritage Organization. I pass the diary across the table.
This is a Confederate soldier. I'm an African American woman. I know the history of Clay County. I know that it was a pro-slavery county. When Abraham Lincoln ran for president, he didn't get a single vote in Clay County.
Cecilia says she hasn't seen this new publication or the original diary, but tells me history books should present the facts without distortion. However, she accepts the museum's right to present a book however they like.
You see what I'm saying? Mm. It's what you are presenting, what you choose to present about this man. But he is a complete character, so you should present him holistically. You know, character is who you are in the dark.
Character is who we are in the dark. If Jana was sanitizing Missouri's Confederate history by willfully ignoring slavery, let's talk to someone who's ready to drag it out into the light.
Well, I don't think that you can get around slavery.
Jeremy Neely is a history professor at Missouri State University, and he wrote a book about the conflict between Kansas and Missouri during the Civil War. Missouri was a slave state, as we've established, and Kansas, right on the other side of the border, was a free state.
I understand that many people would argue that it's about states' rights, and you'll even have people argue that it's about clashing economies and cultures, and things like the tariff were involved. And I'm not denying that maybe those weren't a part, but the way that I teach this in class and talk about it in the book is that states' rights wasn't just a legal abstraction for these people. I mean, this was a tangible thing. There was one particular state's right that was at stake. And for Missourians, it was the right to own and sell human property and to take that human property into the Western territories. They thought that that was constitutional, as it had been, but that their foes in Kansas, the free soilers and the abolitionists, they believed that it was wrong. And so I think any attempt to sidestep slavery as a root cause misses the mark.
Is there something we lose sight of, though, when we remember only the perspective of the winner in this story, the perspective that this was the war to end slavery? I guess my question is, is there a risk of editing out other voices and viewpoints?
Oh, there is. And one of the things that was really interesting to me as I did the research was that this has been a contested history from the start. That in the immediate aftermath of the war, people in Kansas City and in the counties outside of Kansas City on both sides of the state line are waging this struggle about how best to remember the war. When you look at the newspapers, what you find instead is this wide effort to turn the page, and that this was a bloody and awful past, and that people needed to look instead to the future. And that it, by focusing upon what people had in common, their economic interests, for example, that they would put their best face forward, and that would be more inviting to immigrants and to outside investment. And so the big issue in the latter third of my book is this tension between people who believed that you should tell the history warts and all. I really liked that phrase in Danny Wood's piece. And then the people who thought that, no, you need to be selective and to emphasize the more accessible parts of the past, the things that everybody can agree upon.
I wonder how you see this legacy of the Civil War playing out in Missouri today.
I think what's interesting is the ways in which memories can change over time and the ways in which identities can change over time. And many people forget that Missouri remained a Union state. They chose in 1861 not to leave the Union. And granted, eventually there will be a secessionist government that leaves the state as they're chased out by the Union Army. But it's a government in exile. They're attempting to govern Missouri from Arkansas and then from Texas. And so
that's pretty crazy. I mean,
it is crazy.
And that isn't a well-known piece of this history. Why not?
Well, I think that what happens during the war in Missouri is that you have a large number of these people who wanted to keep the status quo, that wanted to keep the Union together, and they also wanted to keep slavery legal. But as the war changes and it becomes a war for emancipation, not just a war for Union, many people go from being neutral to being pro-Confederate. And so there's a shift in Missourians' identities during the war.
I'm curious what you think people's family connections might have to do with how we remember this war. I mean, I've talked to people about this before. I once spoke with a member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, and he was talking about that, you know, of course he does not defend slavery, and but that people in his family, as he had heard it, were starving during the war. And his relative who died fighting for them, as he saw it, was a hero. Regardless of what side of this conflict he was on, he was defending human beings in his own community who were starving. And I get that, I do. But then you could also look at it from the other side and see someone whose ancestor was a slave in Missouri. And how is that person supposed to feel about arguments that this wasn't about slavery, that this was complicated?
Yeah, and I think that family was crucial to the preservation of memory, because what I found in my research is that you really have parallel memories taking root, that in the newspapers you have this booster version of history, and that the war, well, what the war was about really doesn't matter, because they didn't want to talk about slavery. They didn't want to talk about secession.
Yeah, what I've heard the phrase, for reasons best left unacknowledged.
yeah, that's right. What they wanted to celebrate was the common heroism of soldiers on both sides. That these were men who had been heroic and willing to sacrifice, and that regardless of their politics, that they were determined to protect their families and their communities. And so it strips away all the ideological origins of the war. And what happens within families, though, is this determination to tell the history as they had experienced it. And so the hardships, the ways in which they'd suffered, and it was the history warts and all. And what you'll see in the 1870s and 1880s is this memory continues to be passed down generation to generation.
Our family histories inform our sense of who we are. And we all want to feel good about who we are, where we come from. I get that. But there's got to be a way to do it honestly, without making excuses for something as ugly as slavery.
Human memory and human history are just inextricably bound. You can't get over something that happened in your past, even in your own life, that's something you were ashamed of doing when you were 12 years old. You still remember it.
Monroe Dodd is a local historian and journalist in Kansas City. Here's his perspective.
Markers of all kinds are more important than we think. Often we'll pass by a marker every day and pay no attention to it. But it's nevertheless getting ingrained in our minds. And I think everything from a grave mark under a cemetery to a glorious monument to Union soldiers or Confederate soldiers, whoever, replete with flags and statues and all that, all those things serve as what it appears at least to be. Everything in the world is transient, but it appears to be rather permanent. And it appears to, and it will be the kind of thing that sets off a little code in our brains, the way landmarks do, the way places where we met our first love would do, or all the things that go on in the human emotion, in the human mind.
This episode of Midwesternish was produced by Matt Hodapp and Matthew Long Middleton. Sylvia Maria Gross is our editor. Special thanks to KCUR reporter Danny Wood on this episode. You can subscribe to this podcast on NPR One or wherever you generally do that kind of thing. And if you're liking Midwesternish, you can check out Central Standard. That's a daily show I host on Kansas City's public radio station, KCUR 89.3. Head over to kcur.org and give it a listen. I'm Gina Kaufman. Catch you next time.